Okay. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I'm going to be talking about, or we are going to be talking about, right mindfulness, remembering reality. And I'm using an article from this book, the series of writing, The Eightfold Path, series of writings by different Buddhist, most of them are teachers, I guess. This one is by Hoko Konejis. And she is of interest because she is the student of Shaku Okamura, which many of us are reading. Well, maybe nobody here except Mark and I. But Shoku. What?
I just finished some Shohaku Okamura.
Yeah. So she is his student. So he's still living. So, yeah, Shohaku. Yeah. I thought we could go around and read this. She starts, I'll start, and then I'll just pass it around. Starting with, I have little marks, this is where it will start, and then stop, and pick up later. So the four foundations. The four foundations of mindfulness found in the Satipatthana Sutra are familiar to Buddhist practitioners around the world. Dogen Zenji reminded his monks of this teaching in the Dharma Hall discourse. Our Buddha Shakyamuni said to his disciples, there are four foundations of mindfulness on which people should depend. These four foundations of mindfulness refer to contemplating the body as impure, contemplating sensation as suffering, contemplating mind as impermanent, and contemplating phenomena as non-substantial. These teachings were designed to disenchant early Buddhist practitioners with the phenomenal world and help them loosen the grip of craving and aversion. However, Dogen went on to explain that he perceived the four foundations in a whole new way. These may sound familiar. I, Ahi, also have four foundations of mindfulness: contemplating the body as a skin bag, contemplating sensation as eating bowls, contemplating mind as fences, walls, tiles, and pebbles, and contemplating phenomena as old man Zhang drinking wine, old man Li getting drunk. Dogen's particular view of mindfulness is based on non-duality of subject and object. In other words, there is nothing of which one is mindful, and no one maintaining something called mindfulness. While he doesn't take issue with the Buddha regarding the early teachings about mindfulness, Dogen goes beyond the usual conclusions about these elements to see the phenomenal world simply as it is. While his teaching, like that of the Buddha, aims to help us loosen the grip of craving and aversion, it is designed not to discourage engagement with the world, but to allow for full immersion in the world and for the understanding that all things are interconnected. Thus, Dogen's foundations for mindfulness are very much about experience of the world and maintaining awareness of non-separation right in the midst of daily encounters, keeping everything in context. They are about remembering reality. I'm going to pass it around now. If you're so inclined, please read a paragraph or two and on to the next person.
The evolution of mindfulness. How did this shift in the meaning of mindfulness happen? The earliest Buddhist teachings say that all things that arise in the phenomenal world are products of the 12-fold chain of dependent origin, ignorance, fabrication, consciousness, name and form, six sense bases, contact, feeling, yes. Craving, clinging, and becoming, birth. Other than seeing the world as a kind, a wondrous web of life and identifying with it, early Buddhists saw it as a mass of suffering. They saw that things arise because we are ignorant and attached, and that these things are ultimately unsatisfying. Thus, they wanted to do what the Buddha did, reverse the chain of causation in order to eliminate ignorance, the root of suffering. In other words, they wanted to disassociate from our disidentify with the phenomenal world that results from the contact of senses with sense objects.
Today we may think of the chain of dependent origination or causation as a kind of scientific explanation for how natural phenomena are created. That's completely different from the view of the early Buddhists, who used it to show how life within the cycle of death and rebirth is unsatisfactory. For them, contemplating the chain of causation encouraged disenchantment with the phenomenal world and with one's delusive desires for impermanent things. Such contemplation was an encouragement toward the liberation that results from destroying ignorance, the root of the entire chain. Mindfulness of the impurity of the body, the suffering brought about by the senses, the impermanence of what happens in the mind, and the insubstantiality of the things to which we cling allowed early Buddhists to let go of their attachments to the phenomenal world of birth and death and move toward the liberation of nirvana. Early Buddhists engaged in four kinds of mindfulness practice: simple, protective, introspective, and deliberate conceptions. Simple mindfulness is non-judgmental observation and recognition of whatever arises. The practitioner does not draw any conclusions or write any stories about what's happening, but recalling earlier experiences may recognize various elements. Protective mindfulness involves preventing unwholesome states such as greed or dissatisfaction from arising by cultivating awareness of one's mental reactions to data received about the objects of the senses. Introspective mindfulness steps in when protective mindfulness has failed to restrain the senses and unwholesomeness has arisen. Practitioners remind themselves to examine their mental states, to recognize whether or not they are wholesome, and discard those that are detrimental. Finally, in the deliberate forming of conceptions, the practitioner calls to mind what is wholesome and beneficial to serve as inspiration and what is unpleasant to counteract craving. For example, cultivating loving kindness toward all beings may involve imagining them as one's children. Imagining the body as a decaying corpse is a means of loosening attachment to it.
It's not the psychological mind we're talking about here, but Zen. There's no one word in English that serves as good translation for Zen. So it's often called the heart mind. When the Chinese began translating sutras from Sanskrit, they used Zen for Sanskrit terms like citta, manas, and vijnana. All of these refer to various consciousnesses in the Yogacara tradition from which Zen can be said to derive. And that way, Zen takes on a psychological association. However, Zen was also used for the Sanskrit Hridaya, which can mean heart, center, or essence. Zen as citta in the realm of subject and object, or storehouse, consciousness that contains karmic seeds, while Zen as Hridaya means all dharma's phenomena in this one unified reality.
When Dogen wrote about the mind in Shobogenzo Sokshu Shinzenbutsu, thanks for leaving me that one, the mind itself as Buddha, he wrote about Zen as Hridaya. The mind that has been authentically transmitted is the one mind as all dharmas, and all dharmas as one mind. An ancient patriarch said, What is fine, pure and bright mind? It is mountains, rivers, and the earth, the sun, the moon, and stars. As my teacher, Shokuaku Okumura, explained, Ukiyama Kosho Roshi often said that the Zen used in Zen is not psychological mind, but it is rather life, which includes both subject and object. In the 1970s, when I tried to explain this to an American friend, he was puzzled by the expression psychological mind and asked, is there such a thing as mind that is not psychological? In Zen, I think we would say yes. If mind is everything we encounter, then right mindfulness is understanding there is no gap between ourselves and the rest of this one unified reality that transcends time and space.
Approaching the sacred space. While we're at it, we should understand what the original foundations of mindfulness are really all about. The Sanskrit word for the English foundation is usually used is upasana, which means something like to draw near to something with respect. There is a sense of putting oneself in a sacred space and abiding there. When we combine it with smriti, that which is remembered, we get smritipashtana, or in Pali, satipatthana. However, the second part of the compound could also be pasthana, Pali, patthana, meaning a starting point, basis, or foundation. Thus, in English, we sometimes see the four abodes of mindfulness, and we sometimes see the four foundations. How do we put ourselves into the sacred space of mindfulness and abide there? Although we may think of mindfulness as a sacred space, that doesn't mean it's a special state to be found somewhere other than here. If we're fully engaged in the mind that is all dharmas, the eternal now that continues in the 10 directions, then all space and time is sacred space and time. We draw near to things with respect, seeing them as they are, handling them with the care they deserve, not privileging any one dharma over another because all are equally empty. Abiding in that space, there is neither sacred nor mundane, nothing about which to become precious, and we see that we are not separate from anything in this one universal reality. Our practice is to remember and manifest the truth of this.
Okay. Dogen's four foundations. What does Dogen's right mindfulness look like in concrete terms? After all, mind, as all dharmas, can seem rather vague and abstract, not something that's part of daily life. Let's look again at Dogen's four foundations of mindfulness from the Ehi Koruko, on which he elaborated in Shobogenzo, 37 elements of Bodhi. Contemplating the body as a skin bag. In contrast with Shakyamuni's instruction to contemplate the body as impure, Dogen tells us to see the body simply for the skin bag it is, without judging it to be either pure or impure, and without desiring to cast it in an unpleasant light to lessen our attachment to it, and by extension to the phenomenal world. Dogen sees the body as the ground of awakening and thus indispensable. Without the body, he reminds us, there would be no practice, no preaching, no mindfulness itself. When human beings become Buddha, they utilize the human being to regulate the human being and to become Buddha. That's a quote from Dogen. The body is necessary for the kind of mindful, completely wholehearted daily activity that is the realization of our true nature, whether that activity is the formal practice Dogen detailed in his instructions for temple officers or the task of everyday 21st century Western life. However, become fixated on watching ourselves act is not the point of mindfulness, and fixation has the potential to increase our self-absorption. When we act selflessly with no gap, with no subject and object, that is exactly the complete manifestation of Buddha. In the instant of that manifestation, Dogen explains, trying to engage in any kind of additional mental, in quotes, mindfulness exercise is pointless. It would be an attempt to add an extra element to the reality of the body as the entire universe in the 10 directions. impossible. Mindfulness of the body is the body's own mindfulness practice, he points out, and thus there can be no separation between the body and the mind, the body and the universe, or practice and awakening.
Contemplating sensation as eating bowls. In the Tenzo Kyokun, Instructions for the Cook, Dogen recalls the old saying, a monk's mouth is like an oven. Just as an oven does not resist or complain, whether we put in cake, potatoes, or dog biscuits, a monk accepts whatever is put into his bowls. It begins during Takohatsu, alm rounds. When I was practicing in a temple in Japan, we would stop at a doorway and chant for the benefit of the people in the house or business. Sometimes someone came out, and sometimes no one came out. A businesswoman might put a few yen in the bowl, or an old man might give some rice. A mother may give her little son an orange and show him how to offer it. No matter what we received, we chanted, in quotations, the virtue of the two kinds of offerings, material and dharma, is boundless. The perfection of generosity is completed and benefits all beings in the whole Dharma world, end quote. No offering was scorned, and no offering was greeted with delight. All were equally accepted for the sake of the Dharma.
When the offerings were prepared and served at mealtime, they were accepted with the recognition that they represented more than just the physical food in front of us. They represented the larger universe of labor, materials, and energy, and were received with equanimity. Sometimes a local business owner would bring us all of his fresh tofu that was about to reach its sell-by date. It was perfectly fine, and we were happy to have it because our temple was at that time rather poor. However, we had to eat it all within a day or two to avoid having to throw it out, which was an unacceptable end for goods offered to a temple. Tofu was served at meal after meal until it was gone. If we contemplate sensation as eating bowls, we accept the sensation with which we are presented. Just as we accept what is put into our bowls, we take them all in, ignoring none, whether pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and recognize that these two are part of the one unified reality. One way to consider these sensations is as suffering. Unpleasant feelings are no fun, and pleasant feelings are doomed to fade away. Another way Dogen suggests is to consider them simply as elements to be accepted. They are not ours, but neither are they outside somewhere, separate from us. Practicing with a body means practicing with the feeling that arises when the senses come in contact with sense objects. It's not necessary to decide how we feel about feelings. We can simply remain aware of them as they arise without obsessing or fixating on them and without analyzing them to invest them with special meaning. Obsession and analysis simply narrow our field of vision.
Contemplating mind as fences, walls, tiles, and pebbles. If all dharmas are the one mind, then concrete manifestations of phenomenal reality like fences, walls, tiles, and pebbles are also mind. While the Buddha's instructions are to contemplate the mind as impermanent, Dogen uses one of his favorite metaphors for the world of form to show that mind is impermanent. Dharmas are impermanent, and mind and dharmas are not separate. Our challenge is not to forget that everything we encounter is one mind, and fences, walls, tiles, and pebbles are impermanent by nature, just as mind is impermanent by nature. Mind is not somewhere else. It's right here among the forms that make up our daily existence. Coffee cups, smartphones, running shoes are all mind, which means they are all impermanent. Why do we care about this? What makes it more than a set of interesting mental gymnastics? Deeply understanding that all dharmas are mind and that mind is impermanent, we let go of the need to jump to conclusions about whether we like or dislike things and develop the ability to sustain some level of equanimity, even when faced with powerful events that have the potential to carry us away. The Adivamsaka Sutra says, in the sixth abode, the fulfillment of right mindfulness, there is no confusion about the inherent nature of things. Meditating with right mindfulness, detaching from discrimination, one cannot be moved. One cannot be moved by any god or man. Hearing praise or slander of the Buddhas or their teachings of enlightening beings and the practices they perform, or that sentient beings are finite or infinite, defiled or undefiled, easy or hard to liberate, or that the cosmos is great or small, becomes or decays or exists or does not exist, the mind is unmoved. Contemplating phenomena as old man saying, drinking wine, old man lie, getting drunk. Phenomena are non-substantial, yet they are interdependent elements of this one unified reality. Their nature is to arise and pass away, thus they have no abiding self-nature that persists through time. Even so, their arising and passing away is not separate from the arising and passing away of all other phenomena. Dogen's quote about old man Zhang and old man Lai comes from Yunaman's recorded sayings. He's using it here to show the interconnectedness of all beings, and that this interconnectedness is beyond the perception and workings of the intellect. How does it happen when one person drinks sake, another feels the effects? How does it happen that we carry the Dharma into the world without any intention of influencing others to practice? Yet we hear from someone years later that watching how we handled the death of a parent inspired her to learn about Zen. We can't ignore phenomena simply because they are non-substantial. We have to go beyond their non-substantiality and bear in mind both that they are empty of any abiding self-nature and that they are not separate from each other or ourselves, arising and passing away together in a vast interconnected system of causes and conditions.
Dogen's consideration of mindfulness went beyond his repositioning of the four foundations. He included a long extract from the Butu Hanghukikyo Sutra of the collected stories of the Buddha's deeds in past lives. In his Shobo Genzo Ippiyaku Hachi Homi Yomon, 108 Gates of Dharma Illumination, mentions 9 mindfulness-related practices related to this discussion. Mindfulness of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. For early Buddhists, recollecting the virtues of the Tathagata, including his awakening knowledge, conduct, expertise in the ways of the world, and skill as a teacher, allowed them to avoid being overcome by passion, aversion, or delusion. Calming the body, they were better able to concentrate on the Dharma and experience the joy and rapture that naturally arose. This recollection was to be done not only on the cushion, but throughout the day while walking, standing, sitting, laying down, working, or resting. The same effect could be experienced by recollecting the Dharma as well spoken by the Buddha, timeless, pertinent, and to be verified for oneself by one's own tangible personal experience.
Similarly, one recollected the Sangha as compromising those who have practiced well, straightforwardly, methodically, and masterfully, and as representing the incomparable field of merit being made up of practitioners worthy of gifts, hospitality, offerings, and respect.
Complete immersion in these three treasures allows us to reflect them perfectly without gaps or additions. When it is awakening that is awakening, rather than we who are awakening, Buddha is manifested purely. When the universe operates through us without obstruction, the view of the Dharma is unrestricted. When there is no separation between ourselves and the Sangha, there is no chance for wobbling and falling off the path. Mindfulness of generosity. No expectation of reward. Early Buddhism recalled that in the midst of human society defiled by greed, they had the good fortune to cultivate generosity, open-handedness, magnanimity, responsiveness, and delight in giving alms. The joy that arose from practicing in this way was its own reward. Wholehearted engagement in giving means that giving is just giving. As exemplified by Takahatsu practice, there is no self, no giver, no receiver, no gift, and no thought of reward arises. In the one unified reality, there is no giving and no not giving, because everything is already complete. Mindfulness of precepts, fulfilling all vows. While there is separation in our day-to-day existence, we need the ethical guidelines of the precepts as guideposts on the path. When we see through separation, no thought of unwholesome action arises, and we don't break precepts. It's no longer a question of watching ourselves to prevent unwholesome thoughts and actions. There is no one vowing, no one breaking vows, no one fulfilling vows. There is simply the complete and skillful operating of the one unified reality. When we wholeheartedly engage in functioning within that reality, the small self drops away, and effective action for the benefit of all beings occurs naturally. Mindfulness of the heavens, giving rise to wide and big mind. Early Buddhists brought to mind not just the heavens, but also the beings that occupied them, the devas. They recalled that the conviction, virtue, learning, generosity, and discernment of the myriad devas was present in themselves as well. And on that basis, they enjoyed liberation from the three poisons, calmed themselves, developed concentration, cleansed the mind of defilements, and experienced joy. Bringing to mind inspiring elements such as the three treasures or the devas was not meant to be a practice in itself, however. Once the experience of the element had dispelled fear and produced calm and pleasure, the practitioner was to withdraw his mind from the object of inspiration and abandon direct and thought and discrimination. Mindfulness through performance of work. Mindful work is done without a doer, a task, or an outcome. When we are not separate from action, we perform thoroughly. We do all that is necessary with nothing extra and nothing left out. No matter whether the task at hand is simple, like putting books back on a shelf, or more complex, like figuring out why the car has suddenly begun to make a high-pitched whine, we can do it seamlessly. That doesn't mean we do it to the exclusion of awareness that the bookend is about to tip over or that a toddler on a trike is just pedaled up behind the back bumper. As Dogen teaches in the Tenzo Kyokun, each item with which we're working needs to be handled carefully and with understanding about its relationship to all other dharmas. He quotes an old teacher, "When steaming rice, regard the pot as your own head. When washing rice, know that the water is your own life." Years ago, I heard a story about Zen students who worked in a business started and run by their center. They were convinced that their practice required them to do everything slowly and deliberately, carefully placing each object and product just so, and were oblivious to the growing line of impatient customers waiting for service. This is not Dogen's mindfulness.
Mindfulness does not mean slow. Mindfulness has no set speed. It just it just does what needs to be done in full awareness of everything around it. The power of mindfulness, taking responsibility. When we remember the reality of our inner connection with all dharmas, we avoid becoming dazzled by the personalities of others, forgetting to take responsibility for our own thoughts and actions and their outcomes. Otherwise, it was my fault, we tell ourselves later. I just went along with everything, with what everyone else was doing. It wasn't my idea. This is what my Dharma grandfather, Kodo Sawaki, called group stupidity. He had little patience for people who went along with the crowd and abrogated their personal responsibility, or for those who created strategies to lead others astray in the name of money, power, or fame. He wrote, "When people are gone, they're not so bad. However, when a group forms, when people are alone, they're not so bad. However, when a group forms, paralysis occurs. People become totally foolish and cannot distinguish good from bad. Their minds are numbed by the group. Because of their desire to belong and even to lose themselves, some pay membership fees. Others work on advertising to attract people and intoxicate them for some political, spiritual, or commercial purpose. I keep some distance from society, not to escape it, but to avoid this kind of paralysis. To practice Zazen is to become free of this group stupidity. Numbing the mind, intentionally or not, turns off our ability to see the consequences of what we do and effect of our actions or inaction across this one unified reality. If we're really mindful, awake and aware, we prevent unwholesome states from arising, unwholesome actions from being carried out, and unwholesome effects from harming beings." It says end here. So I don't know if that's the end to end. Yeah.
What's that say? Let's put it down to earth. What is it saying? No, I have this. Thanks.
What I picked up is let life do the work.
In a way, I'd say, yeah, just embrace reality, be there with it. Just let it flow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but take responsibility for what you do. Don't just go along mindlessly.
No.
Go along with mindfully. That was a lot. I'm sorry. But I didn't want to not... I guess we could have skipped around a little bit, but... Any other thoughts or reactions?
So I just have a... I always struggle with the term emptiness.
Emptiness.
When used in the context of Zen, and I kind of... I had a realization, maybe we're really talking about when we talk about emptiness as formlessness. Because a lot of times I use the term empty, and I get this image in my head of like, okay, nothing. But it doesn't seem to fit very well often when I hear that. But I struggle with it, so.
Also heard it described as boundlessness, which I find pretty useful. So it's the opposite, kind of like, yeah. I've also heard emptiness described as boundlessness, which can help another angle on.
Anybody else?
That's funny. It's setting up my contrarian streak, right? Normally, I'd be all in favor of an essay that points out that the root of all Buddhist ethics is awareness,
yeah.
Right? I love that. That's one of the reasons why the classical Chan masters don't spend a lot of time talking about ethics. They spend an awful lot of time talking about being awake.
Buddha means being awake.
But at the same time, I mean, also ordinary beings that are getting slapped around by life at all times. Very easy to lose track of things. Mm-hmm. At the same time, as awareness is the root of all those ethical guidelines, the ethical guidelines still have that place. Because they can hold you when you have lost the plot.
I guess I've never heard about this translation of mindful, of the Four Foundations. I'd never heard Dogen's take on that. I like what he says, especially the part of the sensations. He says something about accepting them as bowls, like something about...
empty bowls.
Yeah, I like that. Though...
eating bowls, contemplating sensation as eating bowls.
Yeah, I love that. But I'm a little confused about... So the original teaching said to contemplate the body as impure and to basically disenchant yourself with it. But Dogen, I don't know, he kind of takes it and says, don't think of it this way. It is what it is, and you need it to practice, which makes a lot of sense. But I'm just wondering how, like, the original teachings are the original teachings, and that's where everything is based. So I'm just a little confused about that, the difference between what was originally taught and what Dogen's take is, you know? I'm just going to read it more and see.
Dogen took it further, I'd say. Into where what makes a lot more sense to me, which is the body is a skin bag, more than impure, it just is what it is.
Yeah.
Neither here nor there. I mean, it's not good, it's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it might be, you know, Buddha came from a historical perspective of asceticism, too. So, you know, he had that period also of asceticism. So perhaps, you know, his whole, that was an extreme, right? And, that had to have influenced how we thought as he, you know, evolved, too, I would think. You can see how the original Buddhist teaching leads to a lot of the other Buddhist traditions, right?
Yeah.
Which from my perspective always seem a little bit obsessed with purity, right? And merit. And there's a distinct Catholic whiff to a lot of the Theravadan teachings when I encounter them, at least for me.
Yeah.
So to me, Dogen's perspective is a useful corrective, right? Because obsession with purity is still an obsession. Obsession with impurity is still an obsession, right?
And the obsession of contemplating sensation as suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, sensation as eating bowls. Contemplating mind as impermanent.
So the early teachings, the Theravadan teachings, apparently according to the Mahayana people, was given, so the Buddha taught according to the understanding of the people that he was addressing, right? So apparently he came back and taught the Mahayana on Vajrapik, right? And that's where these teachings come from. That's the only way I can reconcile, because we always take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma. So why don't
treasures.
We take refuge in the, if that's the original teaching, Are we, you know, why don't we take refuge in Dogen then? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, I'm a little bit confused about that. The only way I can understand it is, okay, he came back and taught etymology for people who...
Well, there's also a historical angle, right? Since we're talking about one of Okumura's students,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okumura's take on the first three lines of Genjo Koan, the one where it says, you know, there is abundance and deficiency, there isn't abundance and deficiency, now there's abundance and deficiency again. Okumura talks about that as a recapitulation of the history of Buddhist thought, right? The original Buddhist teachings say there is, you know, delusion and enlightenment, yeah. And then later on there becomes this notion of emptiness that gets taught everywhere and has such a heavy influence in Zen, right? Actually, you know, it's derived from the Buddhist teachings, but it comes on the scene later, by many, many centuries.
Well, in Ramarjuna, people like that. I mean, yeah. So it is from...
Paramita Sutras and all that.
Right. I guess I always try to look for like a connection between Buddha's teaching and Zen teaching. You know, like, what is the connection?
That's why it's so beautiful that Dogen comes full circle and says, you know, in the end, there is abundance, beyond abundance and deficiency, so there is delusion and enlightenment, practice and realization. I love the way he comes all the way back around.
Yeah. That's what makes sense to me. I mean, obviously, contemplating the impurities and stuff, like, I don't know if you know that The Path of Virtue, there's a huge book called the Vishumagadha, about the original teachings are there, and it's like what your body is full of, pus and shit, and whatever, you know, like look at that, and it just makes sense, you know. Whereas if you don't, then without the body, you can't practice mindfulness. That makes more sense, you know. But where's the link?
My teaching just. These different times might they just have
more utility? I mean, maybe Buddha describing the way you described it? I mean, is that just maybe what was the right thing to say for that group of people?
Well, maybe,
Dogen said was right to say for his own.
Well,
the Buddha was originally so concerned with suffering in the world when he came out of his protective life. Young life and saw suffering everywhere. That really affected him and made him feel like that was sensation. That's what happens to people. And Dogen came around, brought it around to something more. I don't know, easier for me to grasp anyway.
Yeah.
More modern almost, even though it was a lot of years ago. It
was 12th century? Was it 12th century?
13th century.
13th century, yeah.
I think religion is always, and it's not just Buddhism, there's always this influence of context, you know, and this interplay between religion changing as a result of the historical context and societal context, and then also the influence that religion has on it at the same time. So it's a two-way street kind of thing. And one of the things I read that's pretty interesting too is that Zen also is there's an influence of Taoism, definitely in Zen, right, that you don't get in previous Buddhism because of obviously where it came from, right, China. So, you know, so again, it's kind of an argument for what your point was.
I will butcher it because I don't remember it correctly, but last Thich Nhat Hanh book I read, he talks about form and emptiness as being these the way that they contradict each other, and yet neither one of them can really fully describe reality. The absurdity of that is intended, according to him, to point you at the reality that is beyond the concept of form and the concept of emptiness. And so in that respect, you can say sensation as suffering is from the perspective of form, and sensation as being like a monk's bowls that receive whatever gets put in them, and that's all there is to it. It's from the perspective of emptiness. Or possibly from the perspective of reality that's beyond either of them, now that I think about it. It's interesting.
Fundamental teaching of Dogen is, I'm losing my voice, his sitting zazen is the essential practice, being present with reality right here, right now, every moment. Mm-hmm. That's what's real, yeah. What you see here now. Not some, you know, myth of the cosmos or some that many religions teach. You know, if this happens, then that will happen. That's what I like about Dogen and Zen. Any last thoughts or comments?
What do we take with us?
What's your takeaway?
Yeah, what's our takeaway?
What I just said? I don't know. What I just said?
Okay, right, present moment.
Yeah, it's very simple, I mean.
It's so easy to get caught up in the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to practice being in the moment.
Be in the moment. That's my takeaway.
Yeah.
Just keep it simple. And be in whatever is there is there.
I'm watching my yellow lights.
What do you mean?
Well, you watch it. There's two or three cars going through yellow lights. We're supposed to stop.
Yes.
And I think that's symbolic of my own slow down. And when the yellow light, you know, and we drive too fast.
Yep, and try to beat it.
You try to beat it. Yes. And that is not in the moment.
Yeah.
I'm practicing that.
That's a good one.
Not
yeah.
to say I haven't run a yellow light, but it's like very symbolic of hurriedness.
Mm-hmm.
It's very symbolic of meditation practice. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. That's right. Yellow lights.
Thank you.
It's kind of safe, though. I watch myself go through those yellow lights pretty often. Like, I'm one of those cars you see.
I saw it today. They just, whoop. And you notice how the cars are doing this in front of you? They're so in a hurry.
Hmm.
With the traffic and everything. And so they need a Zen center.
Slow down, be mindful. It's time time to slow down.
That's time to slow down.
That's a good one. Well, we're at 8:59, so it's just the perfect time to end. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.